Accession number 27748, Reel 8.
Richard Saga, Reel 8. So, you mentioned also that there were other piston engine planes that you had that were on the base. You had a chance to... What were they?
There was a Sea Balliol, which was a Spitfire engine side-by-side aeroplane. And we used to use that. That was their hack. And, if there were... Say there was altimeter needed for an aeroplane, but there was one available. It was just like working for a motor factor. You just drove off in this thing somewhere else, and you had a nice lunch in the wardroom somewhere else, and then you pick up this spare part that was needed, and then fly it back to Abbots Inch for. Yes, I mean I enjoyed doing that because you got a good view of Scotland. Because you didn't. All our other stuff required going to altitude when you were testing the Seahawk, but I mean this was just a cab driving, so you could fly up the Glake Glen or go on that low route between Glasgow and Edinburgh, and then up to Dun. Yeah, it was good fun flying that.
And what other planes?
I think they had a Sea Fire and a Sea Fury.
A Sea Fury was.
That was the radial engined aeroplane.
How did you find the Sea Fire to fly?
Oh, that was lovely, yeah. They were the nice aeroplane. They were, well, they were no nicer than, I mean, I'd much rather fly a Seahawk, because it's modern. There was all the nostalgia stuff, but, there's so many things to do in a piston aeroplane. You've got to watch the cooling and set the flaps accordingly to... or the cooling flaps, so that you cooled the engine at the right rate. You didn't have it too cool, you didn't have it too hot. Whereas your jet engine, it's just going round. You haven't got to do it at all. Also, you've got all that swing on takeoff when you open the throttle.
Through the torque of
The torque, the engine wants to stay still and rotate the airframe around it. And you've got to watch the oil pressure and... any one of those things can mean the end of the engine, whereas I don't think I heard of one of our jet engines ever failing. Not ever. Not in my career, anyway. Whereas several times, you had piston engines fail. After my career in the Navy, I had a piston engine stop on me. It was the points, the ignition points, something as basic as that. But they both failed. Each airplanes have two magnetos to prime ignition, and they both failed within about 5 seconds of each other. So that was clever.
Why were there Sea Fires and Furies at this?
Oh, they were just junk.
So they were just for you to
yes, to just to practice. Just to give you some. Breadth of experience, that's all they were there for. You didn't do anything official with them, no. But the whole ethos of this place was: you read the pilot's notes, you got into it. Nobody told anything about it, or if you passed somebody who thought you could ask, didn't know what somebody was going to say. Oh, don't you know anything about that? Somebody more sympathetic, you'd say, any problems with that? And he'd say, no, just keep it. Watch the store or something like that, and then you go off in it, and that was a tremendous thrill, because it was the first time, and it was up, you'd got yourself ready, you prepared yourself for it, you'd read this, you'd sat in the airplane in the hangar, you worked out where everything was, and then you went, that was a great thrill, just like the first time you took off in the Vampire, that thrill of, like you were a Wright brother. The first time.
So it sounds very relaxed, this place. It almost sounds like...
Oh, it was wonderful.
So you just wandered in.
Yeah.
What's on the books for me today?
Yes, you didn't have any divisional responsibilities. You didn't have sailors to look after. There was what's called a station flight, which were the sailors and NCOs who were running the, you know, state. They ran the ambulance. They pulled the arrest. They had arrestor wires across, but they were not rigged to hydraulic things. It's if you overcook the landing, you know, you could drop the hook, and it would. What it did was pull a whole lot of old anchor chain along behind it. It was very simple. It was just the wires across, and attached to the end was anchor chain flaked like that. And so when you, you know, it took them hours of the Land Rover sort of pulling it and flaking it back again, but it was very effective.
I suppose you had to test the arrestor hook, didn't you, if you were testing these aircraft?
No, you didn't have to do that, but I did. I overcooked a landing once, and it was a question of either going round or had I cooked the brakes. So I dropped the hook and then cooked the wires, and then the duty guys came and put the things back. No, it was very good. It didn't give you anywhere. It wasn't like on the ship. It was just extra braking, you know. But very effective. Say going off the end and making a real fool of yourself.
You say when you cook the brakes, if you put them on too hard, you mean?
No, what I was doing was practicing a forced landing from a long way out. You know, like from that. You know, imagine I had an engine failure.
Well, can you talk us through that? What was the procedure for that?
Well, you said you were obviously quite high somewhere, maybe 25,000 feet, 30,000 feet, and you would say to air traffic, you know, practice. Flame out, in flame, you know, the jet engine is not working, and vectors for a final approach, please. And then they, you know, picked up from you what was happening, and so they would vector you for a very long final, maybe 12 miles out, but they would gauge your height and speed because they had radar. And they would say, you're passing 25,000 feet, should be doing such as, you know, you're 12 miles out at this height, that sort of thing. And then you would decide whether to put the nose down to increase the rate of descent or not, and whether to hold the flaps to the last minute, when to put the undercarriage down, you know. So you were doing all this, and you were obviously keeping a margin. Because if you were doing it for real, you wanted a margin. You wanted to be over the airfield in the end. You didn't want to be over the Clyde. And so you were doing all this and planning all this. And then, of course, with that little margin, when you came over the airfield, then you, well, no, before you got to the airfield, you put the undercarriage down. You probably put down a half flap and keep the last. You know, this is the last thing you've got. One more flap, which you can shorten the distance to travel. And then when you're certain of getting in, you bang that last flap down and straight ahead and land. And I can remember on this occasion, I decided I would land this time, because normally what you do is put it all up again and overshoot and go around again. I'm really doing this for real this time. This is a real practice. But I probably landed at about 120 knots or something like that, too fast. And I was braking, and I had the air brakes out. But I was using up the runway at a vast rate, and so the only thing I could do then was to drop the hook. So I dropped the hook.
And it worked.
Oh, yes, it was splendid, yeah. So that's what it was there for, but not really for practicing.
Did any of the Seahawks you test... did any of those fail?
No, they were all lovely. No, they had, you know, maybe we'd have one that was left wing low or the power controls didn't work. But it was one of those, the Seahawk was a transition aeroplane, so you could fly it manually. Even if all the power controls failed, it was harder work, you know, really hard work, but not too much work, so you could fly it manually.
So in that flame out situation, that long glide, it handled...
Oh, yeah, handled perfectly, because the power controls were worked by hydraulic pressure, and you had a hydraulic reservoir. So if it was for real, because all the time the engine was idling, so it was still giving me hydraulic pressure. But if you were doing it for real, you look at the hydraulic pressure gauge, and you would save, you know, you wouldn't do a lot of maneuvering. You know, you'd keep that. But you knew that if you could always switch off the power controls. They had a switch, and do it manually, and only switch them on for the last bit. You know, that's just where, your experience, you know, came in, you decided what you were going to play for what. I think the Brakes had, if I remember right, they had their own reservoir for one or a couple of really good applications. So whatever you did with the power controls wouldn't exhaust the brake accumulator. Yeah.
And what about the Sea Fury? What was that like, radial engine?
Oh, that was a great beast. You couldn't see out, of course. You had to swing the nose all the time. And you got a tremendous feeling of power from it. I can't remember much else about it. Once it was in a flying attitude, you were perched up on quite a sort of hog's back of the aeroplane, so you had a good view. But the main plane, I think, was slightly, yeah, the main plane was sort of a beam of the cockpit, and so you couldn't see much down that way, only forward and to the right and left. The plane I wanted to fly, and it was the day I joined the first squadron, was the Wyvern, which was a big, when we were doing our aircraft engineering course, the Wyvern was one of the aeroplanes we studied. And it was beautifully made. It was Westland Wyvern, but it had some early, I can't remember what the jet engine was. It was a turboprop. So it had a huge contra-rotating propeller. God, was it complicated. And that was a real hog's back on an airplane like that. And you sat right up here, because it's the only way you could get any view, because the nose is enormous. And it was double-skinned. So a beautiful fuselage, and then inside, instead of seeing ribs, was another skin, you know, to make it stronger. Everything was like that, quality all over. So this is why the lecturer on our airframe design chap, you know, he really went on about the Wyvern. You know, it was just the most beautiful thing. It had the cowlings around the engine hinged up, and they were double-skinned as well. So it was like a Rolls-Royce of an aeroplane. And it had struts that came out and held these things up. You know, it was just beautifully made. The trouble is the engine was very unreliable. And it would overheat. You know, I was saying earlier that jet engines don't overheat. But, I mean, what happened was it used to melt its blades. And it had a bell that rang when it got too hot. And on that squadron, it was for whom the bell tolls. Because when the bell tolled, you had to jump out. You know, because you know, this thing was like a real lead brick. You know, if the engine wasn't running, that huge contra-rotating was like a huge air brake on the front. You know, so it would come virtually straight down. So you had to get out very quick. For whom the bell tolls.
And you never flew one?
No, that was a regret of my life. I'd have loved to fly one of those, just because of that wonderful airframe.
So now we're coming to the sword of Damocles.
Oh, yes.
I imagine. I don't know how long you were at this test.
Well, I'd finished the course, and I was now a qualified person.
Yeah.
And I remember it was Halloween. Yes. So that's just the time, because...
This is
1959.
So this is more or less a year to the day.
Since the ship got back.
Since you wrote the letter.
That's right. Oh, more than that.
So you wrote the letter in...
Oh, yes, I see. Yes, it would have been a year to the day. Yeah, something like that, anyway. Over a year. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it could have been a year. And I was doing a Halloween dance, so we had the mess. I was showing the stewards how to hollow... What do you call those things?
Pumpkins.
Pumpkins to make lights, you know, and there were wrens on this base, and so we had jolly nice wrens, and we were making it like a little nightclub. And I think it was the next day. Oh, maybe it was that day, that's right. I think the dancers, whenever Halloween was, anyway, I got a message from the captain's secretary saying, would I go and see him, you know, this afternoon or whatever. And I went along to see him. I think I hadn't done anything wrong that week. And he said, oh, I'm terribly sorry, old boy, but you've got to be off the station by Friday. What? He said, "Oh, your resignation's been accepted." And I was so dopey. I didn't realise at first what he was on about. And so, you know, I had 3 days to sort of, I managed to sell my sword. You know, I put notices up in the wardroom. I sold most of my uniform, you know, like the dress uniform or the evening dress thing. And I sold my sword and gave all the rest away, you know, because I didn't want the stuff.
Did they let you fly in those 3 days?
Oh, no. No, I asked the CO if I could hedge a last trip. He said, there are never any last trips. Because, you know, what happens? You know, people go up for the last time, they do crazy aerobatics. He said, there is never a last trip. You never know when your last trip is. Yeah.
And how did you feel?
Well, I was relieved in a way, but I also completely at a loss because I hadn't got a plan B. It's really stupid. You know,
but no regret? You didn't think?
Oh, yes, I had regrets, yes, but not regrets for what I'd done. You know, regrets at leaving the Navy, yes. I regretted that, but not regret because I would no longer be put in a position which I found morally unacceptable, yeah. So, I mean, I did have regrets of leaving, because, I mean, you know, I had friends everywhere. You know, the thing about flying is that wherever you go, you've got friends. You know, they're all, you know, scattered around, but, you know, any airfield is another friend's place, you know. So that was a bit of a blow.
And were they surprised?
Well, there were very few of us there. No, I mean, I suppose they were surprised. I didn't have any sort of soul mates to discuss it with.
So that was it? Packed your kit bag, threw it on the back of the motorbike and drove out?
Yes, and drove south. Yeah, and got to... that was it. That was the end. And it was almost 10 years to the day. Because I joined in 49, I left in 59. So it was exactly 10 years.
And when the CO shook your hand for the last time, he didn't say, we're sorry to lose you?
Oh, he probably did, yes. You know, but that's what, you say things like that then, don't you, whether you mean them or not. You know, I mean, that's what it's about, isn't it? I mean, you know, we were all friends. I mean, yeah. And that was about the most relaxed place. It wasn't really Navy, you know, it was a factory outlet for aeroplanes.
So at no point did you feel like saying, actually, I didn't mean that letter.
I'd had 10 years of that, you know, and haircuts and being smart and all this. You know, I was really looking forward. I don't know what I was looking forward to, but something different. It wasn't going to be like that anymore. No.